Now, your favorite music apps are available on Contour from Cox. Go from watching a musical to listening to your favorite music. Enjoy a country western and then a country jam. Go from a love story to love songs. Or go from action flicks to something that makes you feel like an action hero. Now with Contour from Cox.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Jurassic Park Radio. Join host Todd Jurassic as he explores the great outdoors and the great unknown. Here we go.
Hey, welcome everyone to Jurassic Park Radio. This is your host, Todd Jurassic. Tonight's guest is a former Hollywood commercial artist, author, researcher, museum curator, molder of the elongated Paracas skulls from Peru, world-renowned fossil preparer and restorer, Joe Taylor of Mount Blanco Museum from Crosbyton, Texas. Joe, you there?
I'm here.
All right, man. Thanks for having you on, man. Joe is an amazing guy. And probably many of you never heard of the man, but he has had adventures like all of us out there in the world that would like to have adventures wish we did have. But let me just first ask you, Joe, you started out as an artist before going into fossil preparation and everything. How do you make the transition and start out as a commercial artist making billboards and album covers in Hollywood to digging dirt and fossils?
Well, I was decorating the ceiling of a big mansion overlooking Bob Dylan's guitar-shaped swimming pool, and it didn't turn out very well. The client was turned out to be in a group that wasn't a good group. Didn't get paid like I was supposed to, so I just decided to get out of art and go into paleontology, if you can believe that. I was interested in old stuff anyway. You know, that's a but the. The fact that I could sculpt and restore and all that sort of stuff opened the doors. I went to work volunteering for the La Brea Tar Pits, working on dire wolf bones, that sort of thing. So, and I restored some buffalo bones that I'd found, showed them to the curators there, and they all thought they were real. And they were so with such detail and all that, and they branded me as being dangerous. And I said, y'all think I can become a paleontologist without going back to school? And they said, yeah, we'll help you. So they did. And I just started reading all these books and figured Latin has to be like Spanish. So I would eventually figure it all out. And because I now knew people like these guys at La Brea Tar Pits, you know, their name would open doors here in Texas at some of the museums, which opened doors in other places. And before long, you know, they're you're in the inner circle. Because of my interest and like passion, and because I could restore stuff and I did a good job of preparing, excavating, and keeping records, that they just took me in, you know, and began to give me papers that probably no one had ever seen hardly before. So I've got a great file now of what they call occasional papers and other papers. Theses by students, you know, their doctorate thesis. All of them have great facts in them. I was able to separate out the theories and the philosophies from the facts. You know, it's a fact how long a bone is, what kind of animal it came from, and those sort of things. Those are all hard facts. The idea of evolution, we almost never talked about that in the labs because there's nothing to talk about. Because it never happened, so you need to be making stuff up to talk about it. But the facts of the bones, then the knowledge of that animal and how it might have lived, similar to what animals like that live like today. You know, that's the real study of paleontology and of bones and biology. So once you get into that stuff, if you have an inquiring mind like I do, every rabbit trail is to be chased. So no matter what I read, I'd follow up on it. I'd learn all I could about gophers, the difference between the black tail and the white tail gophers in Texas and Kansas area, If you know, there's a little tiny bump back in the last valley of the low of the back tooth. You can tell if it's a black tail or a white tail. Well, that doesn't seem very important unless you know when those things lived and when they died, you know, how long they've been gone. So stuff like that that the average person doesn't see in a museum, those kind of facts tell you something, how animals got where they are and how they couldn't be buried by one event and had to be buried by another. So then you start learning about meteorology, ash falls. Why is this thing buried in white clay? Why is one buried in red sand and so on? Those things are all important. You don't see that in the museum. You just see the bones sticking up there and, you know, they look cool. That's great. That's information. But that tells you very little about compared to what they came from, what was buried with them. So I've tried to make a really comprehensive study of what are found with these fossils. What conditions is the dirt they're buried in? You know, what kind of rock is and so forth, and what kind of plants are buried with them? Extremely important. Most of that stuff is overlooked. You don't see it in the museums, but they tell you a lot. So that's sort of how I got from art into paleontology. I'm not much of a camper. I didn't ever want to be a camper, but you got to be a good camper in order to be a paleontologist if you're going to do any field work.
Yeah.
So I became a good camper. And it's not easy work, as you well know. You know, getting out in the wilds, you have to carry enough stuff, but you can't carry too much, you know, and cameras and all that. If you're going to document anything, you have to have cameras. So it's, I don't like to hike up mountains. Unless there's something up there, I'm not going to climb up anywhere. But if there's something up there I need to know, I will climb up there, no matter how painful it might be. So in that, I'm not just an outdoor adventurer, but you've got to be an outdoor adventurer if you want to learn anything about fossils in the field. And, you know, you look at stuff in the lab, that's one thing, but to know where it came from, what the conditions are, and the whole spectrum of something, the conditions of something, that's where you can start drawing real conclusions. And that's what I'm trying to do, is draw true conclusions.
Well, you're not just – one thing I like about your approach to doing anything is that you try to look at everything, regardless how strange or how weird it is, to look at it for what it is and try to assemble the facts, whether it be some of the stuff that you've done, people don't realize, not just dinosaur fossils, but looking into dinosaurs and humans together and on unexplained oddities, oparts like Dr. Carl Ball in Texas has an iron pot in coal and a metallic hammer from London, Texas in stone and stuff like that. Rather than just chuck them because they don't fit your theories, you try to look at them. You've done some work with the elongated skulls, which we're going to go into a little bit and stuff about that. But I was just curious, you know, what kind of fossils anything in particular that strikes you as odd or interesting that you've been able to look at over the years? You haven't just looked at shells. Joe has looked at stuff that's, I mean, allosaurs, full-size dinosaurs. We're not talking, you know, little shells that you pick off the street. We're talking full-size dinosaurs, and he's been a part of and been doing this for years. So, but you've also seen some pretty crazy weird stuff and talking to you and probably can't even remotely touch in one program, all that stuff. But what kind of can you give a kind of an idea to the folks what big fossils and stuff you've actually looked at and just in a synopsis?
Well, you mentioned Allosaur and the big dinosaurs like sauropods with the long necks, the fat bodies, and the long tail. We were on a site out on the western slopes near Dinosaur, Colorado, excavating a dinosaur, Allosaur, which is like a three-fingered T-Rex, they're like that. Wasn't very big, not a real big adult. But what was noteworthy about it, not only was it articulated, and the bones hadn't really moved since the thing was buried, so it pretty well concluded it had to be buried alive or buried shortly after death. But there was unpetrified wood with it. There was coalified wood with it, and underneath the thing, it looked like it had been laying on a carpet of leaves or something like that. So also above it were these fine little lines about a 16th of an inch of layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, which suggest slightly moving water or moving water. So you don't just dig up the bones and throw the rocks away. The rocks tell you a lot about why is that bone there. Not far from there on the other side with Dr. Carl Baugh, we've been digging since 95. And there are parts of, and I say parts of because every dinosaur exposure, you find it because something's eroding out of the ground. And that means you're either seeing the last bone that's coming out or the first bone that's coming out. And in this case, there's a dozen animals there, and parts of many of them had already eroded out when we found the site. When this little girl actually found the site, and then Carl Baugh found the first of a plate of a stegosaur. So we began digging on it, and we dug for years and finally took out some big hips of a big sauropod of some kind. But this thing was laying on its back with its legs on its back, and its legs were by its side, and they'd fallen over. This thing was buried in liquid mud, and the skin bones, the ossicles in his skin, were still there and pretty much in place. And these bones are sort of flat. They're odd shape. They more or less form a daisy flower pattern. And that's under the skin. They're not really a true bone, but they look like a bone. And there are all these odd shapes. Some of them are shaped like a seven, you know, like a rib in the bone or in the skin. Then on top of that, you've got another layer of bones like BBs, you know, little bitty things. And on top of that, you have the skin and the skin pattern and the color. So this thing's laying there upside down, and animals don't die on their back. They die on their sides, right? Well, if he's laying on his back, that must mean he was buried in liquid mud. And that's what you find. The whole place is liquid mud turned to rock. But strangely enough, here's a little bitty bone that one chip of a chip hammer would have obliterated. It was the lower jaw to a fish. And I researched it and found out, I can't tell you the name of the fish right now. It's a common fish. But the teeth were all still in it on the lower jaw. So it hadn't been dead very long. And it's buried on the stomach of this big sauropod dinosaur, a land animal. There are also turtle bones, there are turtles above it, and at least one stegosaur, if not two, two allosaurs, if not three, a baby sauropod that probably only stood about 25 inches tall, just a little bitty thing, an ankylosaur, an armored dinosaur, upside down. Now, if you know this, all the dinosaurs in North America, all the armored dinosaurs, they have like a turtle shell on them of bones. They're like kind of like an armadillo. They always float upside down if they're buried in liquid mud. Well, that's how you find everything in North America. By contrast, in China, I talked to one of the guys excavating over there, and I said, are all the armored dinosaurs over there, are they on their stomachs? Or are they, you know, pretty much like, well, they're, most of them are on their stomachs, some of them are messed up. Well, over there, it looks like the animals were all standing around, and boom, the sky just burst with 50 feet of sand and buries them all standing up pretty much or on their stomachs. So it probably was not liquid mud like over here, but it was so vast that it couldn't be an ordinary sandstorm. And they've checked the grains of sand and how they're positioned in the strata to see if they're windblown or something else. And that's another thing you don't see in the museums. You know, how the grains of sand are arranged tells you something about, you know, how that dinosaur got there. So in Colorado...
No, you didn't think anything like that.
Pardon me?
It's amazing, though. It's like being a detective. It's
Well, that's
wow.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's all forensics. It's like John McKay from Australia says. We were on a dig up in Montana, and somebody said about, well, this animal died right here. He says, well, we know it got buried here. We don't know where it died. We don't know where it lived. We just know it got buried right here. I said, you're exactly right. It may have died and got buried right there, but just because it's there doesn't mean it didn't come from 100 miles away. Because when the flood of Noah occurred, people think that's a myth. It's not a myth. That really happened. It covered the entire earth with mud and water some places 2,000 feet deep, depositing layers of limestone, sandstone, mud, you name it. And that's why all that stuff is there. but the rock, this thing, this ankylosaur, this armored dinosaur was buried in Colorado. We had a jackhammer, the stuff. You know, I would hold the jackhammer shaft while someone pulled the trigger on it, try to guide it around these bones, but the stuff is just hard as cement, harder than cement in some places. But then when it gets wet, some of it just turns to jello. So this, there was a lens of this white rock that these things are buried in, most of them are buried in right there at this one location. And a lens is like two plates put together, like a flying saucer, you know. So whatever these animals got buried in, they were all washed into one area. And what was around them was this clay-like stuff. And then the layers kept building up on top of them till who knows how many hundreds of feet of layers were on top of them. Well, after a week, they began to fall apart. And the earth shifted. Some big earthquake happened during the flood and caused this layer to move. The layers above it moved, and it just squished all these animals and pulled them apart. In the case of this sauropod, it left his neck and shoulder blades about 20 feet away, but his back stayed in place and the skin on it stayed in place and finally got buried along with his back legs. So that didn't happen. The thing didn't die in some creek somewhere and everybody scavenged it. That happened after it was buried. That's another thing. Mm-hmm. The evolution guys like to always have everything die by some sort of well, they died and they got scavenged and all that. And that's why the bones are disassembled. But that's not really the case in a lot of the time. A lot of times the bones are associated, but they're disassembled because they're buried in layers that moved around during the activity of the flood and subsequent earthquakes. So if you know something about earthquakes, that tells you. You know, you can say, okay, did an earthquake do this? Could it have done this? So now you're into rock, clay, chemistry, water, temperatures, kinds of water, were they electrified? Did they get struck by lightning? Was that a factor in this area? You have to know about floods, moving water. What does moving water do with dirt and mud, clay and rock? What does it do if it's injected with volcanic ash? What does it do if something boils up out of the ground? All these things you have to consider, and if you know enough of those, you can rule out certain things. Like, no, they didn't drown in 2 feet of water here crossing a river like they tell you in the national park over there. You got dozens and dozens of big dinosaurs that are buried over there, and they say, well, they drowned crossing the creek. No, they didn't. They got buried in a massive flow of mud in Noah's flood. They didn't drown in 2 feet of water. You know, their feet are like 20 inches tall. So,
oh, man.
Yeah. Well, and there's also unpetrified trees, and that's another thing. How could a tree be petrified and the bark not be petrified and the whole thing's supposed to be 141 million years old? Please.
Yeah, so you're talking about like polystrata fossils going up between layers is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Correct?
In the southern states, you see them standing upright, and part of them are coalified, some are in rock, some are in clay. Well, anybody knows that those didn't take millions of years to be laid down because trees will rot and fall over in 10 years. So those strata are all being laid down at the same time, different kinds of rock, and on a coal bed, and the part of the tree that's in the coal layer turned to coal and the rest of it turned to rock. Well, in Colorado, this tree was laying down on its side, and probably there are quite a few there, an Araucaria pine, but it was smashed flat. You know, if you took a mailing tube and got it wet and put a little pressure on it, it would smash it into an oval. But the tree wasn't smashed like you hit it with a bulldozer. It had gotten wet, became waterlogged, and the sediments is buried in. And the pressure just caused it to sort of flatten out. But the bark stayed wet. The bark didn't petrify. And we did a carbon date on the bark. And we don't trust carbon date. I don't believe in carbon dating. I think it's all felonious. However, we got a date of 5,000 years on that bark. And it's supposed to be 141 million years old. You know, if you get carbon out of anything, The scientists will tell you, well, it can't be millions of years old. Well, if it's a dinosaur bone, why are y'all saying it's millions of years old? Oh, well, the carbon dates are there, there's something wrong with they've been messed with. Well, no, y'all did all the work. You know, they're not contaminated because you did the work. You know, y'all, that's your job. But the problem is they give a date they don't like. So they're trees today, live trees in, I think, in Yellowstone Park. A friend of mine told me he had a ranger friend there. He says, there are trees here that they're petrified, but they're still alive. The outside bark, the exterior of the tree is petrified. And why is that? Because if you know anything about volcanoes, volcanic gases petrify things. So these trees are what, millions of years old and they're still alive? No. They're maybe 150 or 100 years old, and the gases up there have petrified the outside of the tree, and the inside is still alive. So what does that say about petrifaction? Petrifaction is because of the condition something's buried in, not the age necessarily. So we've been told all these years, we've been led to believe in museums that the dinosaur bone is brown and it's petrified. It must be millions of years old. No. I've got bones of buffalo killed by the Indians 200 years ago. They're just as brown as all the dinosaur bones. And sometimes these things are petrified. I've seen black buffalo bones that are as hard as a rock. Well, nobody's saying these things are more than 300, 400, 500 years old. So if they're black and hard as a rock, are they millions of years old? No. It's just the conditions they're buried in. So why would we say dinosaur bones are millions of years old? Because they're petrified and brown.
Because there's an agenda.
Yeah.
That's a good question. There's a lot of good questions. And so you've got to stay – you have to be objective is what you're saying. So you can't just – well, have a theory and, you know, it's millions of years old, therefore we're going to make everything fit that theory. Instead, you've got to go and look at things, the facts for what they are, and the facts do not point that these things are millions of years old is what you're saying. So, which leads me along that same line on that stretch of that river in Texas you're talking about there by that national park. is that where you guys found the Taylor Trail, which has the trail of dinosaur and human tracks in the same layer?
Yeah, that's the Taylor Trail found by Stan Taylor and developed by him back in the late 60s and early 70s. A lot of people have worked on it, but Carl Ball came along, I don't know, 30 years ago maybe, and he started really working down there with the landowner. And every year they've been down and taken off another layer of sand, of limestone, to see if there's any tracks under it. And, you know, almost always there's a dinosaur track or two, and occasionally there'll be something that can only be made by a human. Now, did a human make it? I don't know. I wasn't there. I didn't see the human make it. Did a dinosaur make that track? I don't know. I didn't see him do it. So, okay, you didn't see the dinosaur make the footprint, but you believe it's a footprint of a dinosaur, right? You didn't see it. I didn't see the human make the footprint, but I can't say it's a human footprint. You know, it's not empirical science, really. It's just, it's obviously some dinosaur made that footprint. And I'm a carver. You know, I know carving. A lot of the stuff they say is carved down there, but the one we uncovered that I actually personally uncovered with Carl Ball and a Japanese scientist, it's called the Japanese track. It's right next to a dinosaur track, but there's no animal I know of can make a human footprint or anything like it. Not an ape, not Bigfoot, anything else. Humans have unique feet. So, you know, the Japanese didn't have any problem believing it's a human footprint. Why do we? Why are Americans so hard-headed to believe that man and dinosaur lived together? You know, it's because they've been taught this nonsense for 150 years, and we're so stupid we believe it.
Yeah, we push our opinions across the world because we're the top power still. What kind of have you run into any other kind of evidence of dinosaurs and man being together?
There's all kinds of stuff. Carl acquired that pot found in coal, beautifully made, small thing. I've seen the hammer. He had someone else mold those two objects, and then I have a cast, and I've remolded them and cast them for sale. So I know quite a bit about them. I've studied them quite a bit. They're obviously well-made human artifacts. They're found in strata that has to be, by the evolution, given to by millions of years. So, you know, either man and dinosaurs live together, or dinosaurs can make beautiful pots. there's a lot of let's say we don't find human and artifacts or tracks with dinosaurs. What can we tell about the dinosaur tracks or the dinosaur layers that tells us whether or not it took a long time for these things to be laid down? That's why that's where you have to look at the strata. Next time anybody goes to the Rocky Mountains or any place where the strata has been exposed, just look at it. They're flat for miles upon miles upon miles. And there are dozens of these layers. They're all made up of different kinds of clays, rocks, sand, coal beds, and all that sort of thing. They're flat unless they've been buckled, you know, by tectonic activity. How could they possibly have been flat without any canyons eroding into them if hundreds of thousands of years went by between them? Well, yeah, no, you have to have canyons. You have to have erosion, and there is no erosion. And that's pretty well worldwide. We're just over in Israel. You know, from one end of the country to the other, it's flat strata. You get down towards the middle or up around Jerusalem and all the way down, it's folded and bent and all sorts of things when it was wet, okay? So that means all those layers were wet at the same time. Are you going to tell me that one layer stayed wet for a million years and another one got in there and it stayed wet for a million years? You know, nobody believes that. They're all wet at the same time. They got folded at the same time during the convulsions, during the flood, or after, during the abatement, which then washed a lot of the hills away. So, okay, you've got all these flat layers in there that had to be laid down at once. What does that say about the dinosaur beds? They're all laid down at the same time. Within a year, so we don't have millions of years now to form those beds. So why do we say they're millions of years old? Oh, well, we've got uranium dating. Come on. You know, anybody that knows that stuff knows that uranium dates, there are like 30 things you can't test in uranium dating, and there are 30 things we don't know. 15 you can't even test. So why is it conclusive? It's conclusive because it fits the presumptions of the agenda. You know, they say these are 140 million years old, you know, or whatever. They're always getting these uranium dates, and they get a date they want. If they get a date they don't want, they throw it out because it's contaminated. Well, come on, that's like flipping pennies and just counting heads.
So
is it a conspiracy?
Yeah,
you know, whatever.
So, so the potential's there that – there are people out there that are willing to destroy possibly evidence that's pretty damning and to their viewpoints, and because the viewpoint's more important than the actual facts, even though they're saying that they're, you know, hey, we believe this and we're pushing this and we're excited about it, but when something comes to attack and, you know, undermine their whole belief system, they're willing to destroy stuff. So I've seen that in the realm of people being here before Columbus. There was actually a Hebrew writing out in New Mexico that was someone took a power, went out in the middle of the woods and sanded it. So, and I know this has happened with some of the artifacts that seem to push in the belief that there was a flood like Noah's, as opposed to evolution, and some of the stuff gets destroyed, gets broken, gets painted over, and that's really a shame because this stuff is important. It should be left alone, and if you have a problem with the ramifications, if it's real or not, you should just, you know, don't look at it. Go and do what you're going to continue to do and just forget about it, and you know what, but don't destroy the artifact. But so there's a lot of things out there. In your opinion, are the Ica stones, the Amka Barrel artifacts, and other items like that occasional pop up in the Mayan culture and all throughout South America, there have been artifacts that appear to have dinosaurs carved on them. What do you think of those?
Well, Vance Nelson wrote a great book on cataloging these things around the world, went to a lot of these locations to show that here's an ancient artifact way before we had dinosaur books, something hundreds or thousands of years old, that depict dinosaurs as we have come to believe they look today. So how's that possible? Well, you know, there's all kinds of stupid theories. One of them is, well, that's the memory that we have of our ancient ancestors saw dinosaurs. Come on. There's no proof of that. they it's in their memory? No, they saw them and made depictions of them. Same way in Colorado and Utah, there are drawings out there of dinosaurs. And we know that by the rules of anatomy, that's what they look like. Well, they didn't see the bones because out in Utah and Colorado, the dinosaurs, no matter how big they are out there, they just get rolled off a little bit at a time. Every year, another inch is gone. So in, you know, 300 or 400 years, all you've seen is bits of bone coming out. You can't tell what they look like. So the Indians weren't looking at whole skeletons laying on the ground. They were looking at real living animals that did those drawings or whoever did those drawings. Down in Glen Rose, one of the most, one of the clearest tracks in the Taylor Trail, I could think of the name of it if I tried hard enough. All those tracks have a name. But they were the creation guys are down there working, and they all went to church Sunday morning. Well, somebody knew that they were going to be in church that Sunday morning and went down there with a crowbar and damaged that track. Okay, so if it's just a dinosaur track, why would you damage it? And isn't that against the law? Well, someone was seen down in the river with a crowbar. I won't say who it is. But I didn't see him. But, you know, why damage it? Why destroy it if there's nothing to it? Why are people so angry at God if they don't believe he doesn't exist? Why get mad at him? I don't get mad about Santa Claus. You know, I know Santa Claus doesn't exist. It took me a few years to believe that.
Point.
You know, I gave it up last year. You know, it's like a lot of things. there's no reason to dispute something if it just isn't true. If it just does exist, why dispute it so vehemently? Well, that's because it is true, but it goes against their partying. You know, people, all these scientists, they're like everybody else. They like to party. You know, even scientists, the big brain scientists, you know, they're boring and nerdy and all that sort of thing. Hey, they like women too, you know, women like them. And they're no different than anyone else. You know, they're no different rock stars. And, you know, so people are people. They're tempted by money. A lot of these, a lot of academics know that what their work is disproving evolutionism, but they don't dare say it because they'll lose their job. And they're not going to lose their job. You know, they've got mortgages and lifestyles and that sort of thing. But it's happened. You know, there's been a couple of hundred that have been recorded by Jerry Bergman, who did a great job on it's called Slaughter of the Dissidents, those that dissent. And some of these people, like a lady, I think over, or maybe she's in Poland somewhere, she goes to her constituents. She says, hey, these carbon dates on the stuff are wrong. The stuff isn't that old. Well, they took her keys, put her to work in the basement, you know, filing papers or something like that. And she was out of a job, but she had the guts to go ahead and say, no, this isn't right. This is not true what we're saying about this stuff. That's happened hundreds of times. And, you know, I've been told personally by people in museums that they don't believe this stuff. They know it isn't millions of years old, but they got to keep their jobs, you know? Well, that's pretty pathetic.
It is really pathetic.
That's not science. You can't say you're a scientist if you lie. That we all presume scientists don't lie. They may be wrong, but they're not lying. They're telling you what they think. But if you know you're wrong and you lie about it, you know, you can go to jail for that if you're in the pharmaceutical business, but not
That's
in the paleontology business, because, you know, they can say anything they want to and put up in these museums and people think it's fun. You know, it's true. So it's a different world.
Well, it amazes me that you could have millions upon millions of buffalo across United States plains, you know, 150 years ago, and now there's virtually no evidence, just any kind of exposure, and yet somehow we're supposed to believe that bones that have been in the ground have been there for millions of years. Granted, they're buried still, you know, it's hard to believe. I mean, and I've seen some things in my life, artifact wise and others, that have contradicted stuff, and I know it's not just in the realm of evolution. It's in the realm of hey, was there someone here before Columbus? It doesn't matter what area. If there's an established viewpoint and you come against that, somebody's got a job they're watching out for, and they're afraid to lose it. And people are willing to. It's just like
they're willing to self-censor themselves and others too at some point because they want to keep making the bucks. And some people, you would think you'd get into a field and you love the field that you're getting into, and you wouldn't desire to, you know, bury stuff just because it didn't fit your viewpoint that you originally had when you started. But with some people, that is the case. But along these weird stuff, I guess you were one of the ones, or probably the main one that molded those Paracas skulls, the elongated skulls that could be considered by some, like L.O. Marzulli, Nephilim. You were the one that molded those, so that's an example maybe possibly of human giants. You've gone several times on projects with him and stuff, but what did you think of those skulls when you saw them?
Well, the skulls from Paracas are some of the longest that we've ever seen, and there's another company that's molded a couple of really long ones, and I've seen casts of those. I know the people. But, yeah, I went down there. I've molded three, four skulls, very limited circumstances under really tough conditions, but we got them done. We couldn't take them with us. We couldn't leave the museum with them. So, you know, I'm able to do things on the fly. but now these, they may be Nephilim. We're still looking at it. In fact, Marzulli's doing a lot of work right now to see if he can determine, you know, what is the genetic makeup of these people, because that really hasn't been done satisfactorily yet, at least on a larger number of specimens. The ones we've looked at, the ones I've looked at, there are no giant skulls there. Now, there may have been at one time, but those usually disappear, especially now since they've become really popular and fascinated with, you know, people are fascinated by them. But the ones we looked at, the one I just finished that ended up on Ancient Aliens show, which a lot of my stuff has, I don't agree with their viewpoint, but that was a really long one. The odd thing about that, they did DNA on it in a New York lab where I sent the real skull to after I molded it. And I think if they could have gotten any kind of questionable DNA that said, well, we're not sure what this is, it's strange, I think they would have said so. But what they said, unless they were making stuff up, they said, it's of Scot origin. It's of Scottish origin. Now, wait a minute. I thought these were all Peruvians, the brown-skinned Peruvians down there. That's the long-headed people, right? Well, what's a Scotsman doing down there? And I said the skull was that of an 18-year-old, a 17-year-old female. They said it was a 12- to 15-year-old male. So, you know, I don't know how we can determine that. But at either rate, if she's as old as I said she was, why are her teeth, why are her back molars worn down and the front aren't? And by the way, why are her front teeth shoveled out like a North American Indian if she's Scotch? And if she's actually Scot, did she have red hair, white skin, blue eyes, green eyes? You know, and why is her head one of the longest ones down there? That has to be done when you're a baby. So was she born there? Were her parents immigrants from Scotland? We haven't heard that before. Let's look into it. You know, this is a fascinating story. Or are all the Paracas down there, were they all Scotsmen with long heads? You know, some real great questions here. And that's what you get into when you start doing try to do the science on this stuff. And it's not easy. You know, L.A. has gone through trouble to find out stuff. And he still is. You know, I mean, he's done a lot. And me too. You know, we've all put ourselves on the line down there trying to find out about this stuff. So, you know, it just raises all kinds of questions. One thing I think, at least in my little circle of people researching, is the Nephilim and those coming out of the Levant over there in, you know, the Middle East, Israel and Turkey, et cetera. It seems to me that when you look at the artwork of these various countries, you see the same symbols, very different art style, but the same symbols, the same characters doing the same thing. The technology is, the artifacts look different, but the technology is still impressive, very impressive, if not unbelievable. We can't figure out how they did it, moving those stones and all that. What it says is these people were, it's just been a couple thousand years since they all got off Noah's Ark. they all knew each other. They're all cousins. They're brothers. And, you know, whenever they left the Middle East over there, whenever they did, after the breakup of the languages, or at the time of when Joshua was killing all the giants, or when David was killing all the giants, apparently all those people left and went to South America, China, North America, and et cetera, and some of the islands, and set up their kingdoms there with this, what we're calling advanced technology, and all of a sudden it springs up out of nowhere. And either the native people were already there, or they came around later, and then now they have dominated. They're the dominant strain there. But what it says is these people are separated by millions of years. You know, they all came from a central source. That's why all these ancient civilizations all have the flood story. Why do they have it? Because it actually happened. And it's the most major event that could be recorded. They recorded that. Almost all of them know about Adam and Eve, you know, and the bad angels. They all know that stuff. And that's because we're not separated by millions of years. You know, we didn't come out of Africa. Ham went to Africa and stayed there. But the rest of them, Shem and Japheth, they all went all over the world. And Africans did too. But by and large, the Africans have stayed in Africa. So we didn't come out of Africa. We came out of Mount Ararat in the Middle East. So all this stupid stuff about out of Africa, you know, and then we came from apes, became Africans, and finally got to be white people, is just disgusting nonsense. And yet it's taught. You have to say, yes, that's true, to get your degree in a college. You know, it's just revolting to me that we do that. And that's what's been done now for 150 years. And today, all these big brain scientists teaching classes up there in paleontology, geology, anthropology, and so on, teach that nonsense as truth. The truth is right in front of our face. It was Ham, Shem, and Japheth. They went to Africa and the Middle East and then the rest of the world. That's the facts.
Yeah, I mean, it amazes me that it's gone out that far, and some of it, like you said, is right in front of your face. And it's just people just – I guess that's what deception's called. And sometimes we just don't want to see what's right in front of our face. Now, have you found anything on your own research as far as giants and stuff like that? Have you gone and done anything and on research of your own? I know that at one point you've gone with Ron Moorhead, who's famous in Bigfoot circles for the best recorded sound ever. In the Bigfoot world, you've done some stuff with him. And have you done anything as far as other giant research?
Well, we went up to the Lovelock Cave in Nevada twice and talked to the Indians, talked to museum people, talked to private individuals. Yes, there were giants there, 7, 8, 9, 10 feet tall. Yes, they had long red hair. And the Smithsonian could deny it if they want to, but they did exist. The Indians, the Paiutes know all about it. They've written books about it. Yes, there were giants there. There was a giant found over on the New Mexico-Texas border back in the 30s. So I went to that town and asked if they archived their newspapers. And I said, well, you got one from 39? Oh, man. So we had somebody in here helping. They wanted to get rid of all the old excess stuff, so they burned all of our old newspapers up to 1939. So if there was a story in there about this 12-foot-tall man they dug up, it was burned. So a dead end there. And I called some of the older people in that area, and they didn't know anything about it. Nursing home guys just didn't know what I was talking about, but they're you know, not doing very well. So there was one, there was a cowboy called me up about 15 years ago, said, I want to tell you my story. So I went down to his place, turned the recorder on, and he started telling me about when he was a sophomore in high school. He was out working the canyons down there in the red beds and came across these giant bones sticking out of the ground. So he called up Texas Tech, and they sent a professor over there who happened to be a North American Indian, and they dug up this 12-foot man. And, oh, by the way, they dug up a 3-foot-tall man with him. Wait a minute, 3-foot-tall? Could that be a real human? Yes. There are people shorter than that are normal human beings. You know, we act like that everybody in the world is 5 or 6 feet tall. No, there are people that, you know, that are up to 18 inches, and they're normal people. but that goes against the stupid evolution lineup. And so what's he doing with this giant man? Well, I've heard of three of these burials where a man 12 foot tall was buried with a man 3 foot tall. Why? I don't know. It's like, why do girls in high school, the blonde girl goes to the girl with black hair? You know, it's just, it's cool. It's fun. You know, so I went to that gravesite. The guy took me to the gravesite, and I got stuck in the river with my pickup, had to be towed out. We finally got up to the top of this hill, which is just a big mesa in Texas, and you could see where the rocks of the burial were, and I didn't see any bone fragments, but those were all dug up in the 60s, and were on display in the Texas Tech Museum, and the guy says, well, they were vandalized in the 60s, and we don't know what happened to the bones. So, dead end. I went to Seymour, Texas, where it was reported there was an 18-foot-tall man dug up. Now, 18 feet? Come on, that's, you know, we're not talking normal people here. That has to be one of the Nephilim. So, was he before the flood or after the flood? Well, I know the topography down there. I know there's a lot of, you know, you go down the creeks, they're full of sand, and there's layers of sand down there that fan out, you know, where the old creeks were, the old rivers. So I thought, okay, was he in clay? That clay is tough. That red clay is tough, and the bones are hard of the dinosaurs buried down there. So got to looking into the story, and the story was this oil man was out prospecting, came on these bones, dug up this skeleton, 18 feet tall, had it looked at by medical doctors and so on. And I'm thinking, okay, if he dug it up, it had to have been in sand, you know, where you would find mammoth bones. If it's in sand, it's after the flood, because before the flood would be that red mud over there of the so-called Permian. But he must have found one in sand. So either it was a burial after the flood, or some guy got trapped, you know, and there was a flash flood, came up and buried him in the sand. And so I've got these news articles. The lady says, well, there's another news article here about that. So look at it. And the last thing I read was they're hoping the Smithsonian would look at it. Okay, dead end. Smithsonian gets a hold of it. That's the last you'll see of it. So I know an Indian fellow, and he says, we know who's in those mounds out there. That's the bad white people with the red hair. Well, yeah, can we come dig one up? Well, that ain't easy, you know, because the federal government has made it, you know, so you really can't dig anything up. But so this Indian guy said, we know those people. Yeah, the Indians knew there were these giants. Most of them were white with red hair or blonde hair. They were all bad. Well, that sounds like you're racist. You're racist against white people. No, the giants were fathered by someone that was white. You know, an angel. Was he an angel with blonde hair? Well, figure it out yourself. Anyway, they were redheaded. They were tall. And they were wicked because they're not normal people. All right. Most of your accounts of giants across North America, at least those told by the Indians that knew them or had stories about them from their ancestors, they were almost always bad people. Well, you know, there's a lot of bad white people out there, but that doesn't mean all white people are bad any more than means all Indians are bad. So the story about these things, there have been hundreds of them dug up in my book, Giants Against Evolution. I chronicled, you know, some from everywhere I could find something. And there are many, many more that have been dug up that I didn't recount. So why don't we have one at every major museum? And I think the answer is simple. It's not because we don't have the bones. It's not because they don't have 60 of those giant redheaded mummies from Lovelock Cave in storage somewhere, unless they've destroyed them. It's because if you put a giant man up there 8 or 9 feet tall, what are people going to say? They're going to think, gosh, that's like David and Goliath. Can't have that. Can't have people talking about David and Goliath because that's in the Bible. And now you go over there, you're going to validate the Bible because you validate giants. That's going to validate the do's and don'ts. Can't have that because we want to keep partying. And if you're going to make us feel guilty about partying and cheating on our wives, then we don't want it. Okay? So it's not a matter of science. It's a matter of morals. And I've had them tell me that, too. It's not a question of science. They know the science is against the is on the side of the Bible. But, you know, there's the Bible again. It tells you do's and don'ts. That's the problem, sin.
Well, that's crazy stuff. So have you debated in a forum any, scientist evolutionists when it comes to this kind of stuff? Or?
I've debated them and online and that sort of thing, but anymore you can't, since Gish and Morris from the Institute of Creation Research, since those guys, you know, been really prominent the last 20 years or so, they know their stuff so well, so good. They know all the evolution side so well that evolutionists won't debate them because they know they'll lose. And they'll say that. Don't debate them, you'll lose. Why would these brilliant evolution scientists lose? Because they're wrong. And Gish and Morris, those guys and others, can show them from your own writings. You've contradicted yourself and disproving your own theories. So they're not going to debate us.
It's amazing when you go online and stuff that you go ahead.
Yeah. Occasionally one of my digging buddies, you know, guys that are actually real diggers, we'll get into it. And, I try to be fairly nice about the whole thing. It's hard to be a Texan, you know, to be nice about stuff. But I asked one really great paleontologist one time. He's doing great stuff, and I won't say who it is. But I said, name me one thing that the theory of evolution has done for mankind. You'd think he'd throw out 15 medical reasons. He says, well, it's made us want to be take better care of the earth. Come on. Really? Because of evolution, we're going to take care of the earth? You know, for 150 years, we believe in evolution, we didn't take care of the earth. You know,
he
didn't have an answer.
No, they don't cover and mention some of the totally racist views of Charles Darwin and the differences. I mean, just his opinions of certain cultures and stuff, and you know, they cut and paste, and if you look it up, it reminds me a lot of kind of like with Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood and how she's praised, but if you read her writing, and she was just absolutely a nightmare, you know, a lot of stuff that way. But you get online and you see every textbook in every school, it's man and dinosaur live millions of years apart, and it's, you think it's set in stone, but it's not. But you know what? If you're willing to lose your job, or you don't care, and you more care about the truth like you do, you're willing to say the truth. But anyhow, we are coming close to ending the show on this end. But I want to have you on again because we're working on something together that's really pretty amazing. But I wanted to ask you if there's anything that that you're working on, future projects or anything you want to talk about, anything else you want to add?
Well, I'm restoring parts of a really, really big mastodon from Indiana. And it may be a record. The thing is enormous. and that points to something. You know, I was told all of my years in school and, you know, what little college I took, that everything started off little and got bigger and more complex, animals, and they finally turned into people. Really? Where's the evidence of that? You know, I've cataloged in my book, I cataloged dozens, if not hundreds, of almost every kind of animal. They're enormous in the fossil record. They were gigantic in the past. They weren't small and simple. You know, some of these things had nose, like some of the antelope had horns on their up by their ears, but they also had horns on their nose. Some of the rhinoceros had
six unbelievable
horns and saber-toothed teeth. Yeah, these things are huge. So the fossil animals, they should never use those as an example of things are getting bigger and better. They completely contradict that. Even the three-toed horse, the little three-toed horse, has 12 toes on his feet, not four. 12 is more than four. 12 be more complicated than four. Okay?
That's true.
So it just isn't what they're saying is not true. The fossil record totally disproves it.
That's true. Anything as far as that
as far as information people can get a hold of you or check out what you're doing? You want to go ahead and give where people can get a hold of you?
They can go to my website is mountblanco.com, MTVLANCO.com. And it's hard to keep it current because I don't have anybody working on it now, but you can get a lot of information off of it. You know, I'm also a professional artist. I've done just about every kind of art you can possibly imagine. In fact, I saw my arts, my lettering in Israel and in Turkey and in all over Peru. If you go to your computer and look under your font section and under a typeface called Bauhaus or Pump or Blippo Black, that's one I designed back in 1970. It's on just about every computer in the world. I should have been a millionaire off of that, but that ain't the way business works sometimes. But you know, I've got half of my museum, part of my museum is a collection of billboards that I painted and saved of all the big rock and roll country guys back in the 1970s and 80s. And that's, you know, what that has to do with fossils. It has nothing to do with fossils, except I'm the artist.
Well, it's amazing how your art career has helped you with, you know, just the detail. And geez, you could have been a forensic scientist with your, you know, being able to look at things and look directly at stuff and see 50 things, and I'm looking at scene two. That's just amazing. But if you want to mention something real quickly, just generically, kind of what you helped me with, and, you know, we'll kind of wrap up with that, and just kind of generically, because
what you guys showed me out where we went last week or whatever it was, 2 weeks ago, unless I'm totally mistaken, it is the most important thing I think I've ever seen in the fossil record. It should not be there, but it proves that during the so-called dinosaur era, there were intelligent men making objects that look like they are made today. And I think I think it needs to be thoroughly looked at by a lot of people, not just me and you. So I'm going to make a cast, I hope, make them available and let people come in. Hey, take a look, light it however you want to, measure it, and you tell me what you think it is. And then we'll just make a compilation of this stuff. But I think it'll silence the idea that man and dinosaurs didn't live together. I think it's one of the most important things I've ever seen.
That's crazy. It's remarkable. And it's remarkable because I would have to say it was God who found it, because I was taking a hike that day and we had heard about this, but years ago, and we weren't even looking in that spot. But my friend Mike and I were just hiking that day. I wanted him to go out in the spot, and we stopped to take a break and look down in this water. And he said to me, "That doesn't look right." And I said, "Hey, those objects." And, you know, here we are 3 years later. But we're going to be showing pictures and having other stuff come out here soon. But, you know, Joe came up and, you know, fought through his own physical pain and molded. We tried to speed mold something, which is not easy if you're molding and doing stuff like that. There's a price to pay. But, you know, it's going to be pretty interesting. We're going to release some stuff here this next week and with this podcast thing and kind of go from here. But, you know, I want to thank Joe for both coming on and for helping with that. And it's pretty exciting, and hope, you know, this will lead to more discoveries and some things we'll learn along the way. But Joe, I want to thank you for coming on, man. I appreciate you. You're a good guy.
You're welcome.
This speed show here, but I wanted to, you know, thank you for coming on here, and show's going to go off here in a minute, but everyone, thank Joe Taylor for coming on. Check out his website, and, you know, he's got two books. The book on giant stuff is pretty amazing. Some of the stuff he's had in there, more unusual stuff that I haven't seen in other people's book, like giant animals and such. But anyhow, Joe, thank you for coming on, and we're going to close off for the night. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, You've been listening to Jurassic Park Radio with host Todd Jurassic. Find us on Facebook and at JurassicPark.net. send your own mysterious encounters and stories to toddjurassic@gmail.com. God bless, and thank you for listening.
Now, your favorite music apps are available on Contour. Go from watching a musical to listening to your favorite music. Enjoy a country western and then a country jam. Or go from action flicks to something that makes you feel like an action hero. Now with Contour from Cox.